You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at cvillepodcast.com. Now available through email, sign up on our homepage. I'm Dan Gould. The program you are about to hear is part of the Virginia Festival of the Book, held in Charlottesville, Virginia, from March 21st through 25th, 2012. The festival was sponsored by the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. It was originally recorded in the City of Charlottesville Council Chambers by Charlottesville's TV 10.
Good morning. I'm Nancy O'Brien, and I'm here to moderate this very interesting panel. And I appreciate you all finding parking spaces. I understand that was a little difficult this morning, which is a good sign for the book festival, I think, but say it for us. And so I'm glad you're all here. We have a very distinguished panel. And I must admit, I've lived here over 40 years, though I know there are people in the audience who have been here a little longer than that. And when I saw the title, What I Didn't Know About Charlottesville, I said, but you know what? There was a whole lot I didn't know, and I'm sure there's a whole lot more I still don't know. So welcome to our learning experience this morning. We're thankful to the City of Charlottesville for providing this space where the City Council usually meets. And we're also grateful to Charlottesville TV 10 for taping this. We are live on TV right now, and we will be shown over and over again during the year because they do run these programs on some kind of a rotation during the year. So if you want to revisit it, you could do that. I'd like to introduce, first I'd like to thank also Davenport & Company, who is hosting this morning's event. And they have been very helpful in supporting the book festival this year, particularly with Charlottesville 250. So that's a very important thing to know, and we can thank them. Is anyone here from Davenport? We could give you a hand if they... Okay. Well, I hope you're watching on TV. One very important thing is if you've got one of these or anything else that goes bump in the night, would you please turn it off? We are on TV, and it makes a mess of the production if you even are on vibrate. The festival comes here every year. It's one of my favorite times of year. I hope yours, too. And it is mostly free of charge. It is not free to put on, however, as I'm sure you're aware. So if you are so inclined, you could visit the Virginia Foundations for Humanities website or drop them a check in the mail and say how much you've enjoyed the book festival and want it to continue. Your support would be very appreciated. There are evaluations that I think you've all gotten on the way in. And I hope you'll fill those out and give them to the volunteers on your way out. It's really important for us to continue the program in response to how you all feel about what you've heard and what you've learned. After this presentation, we'll have time for questions and answers, and then we'll have a book sale at the end, so you can come forward and buy a book and the authors can sign them for you. And that might be something you want to take home, particularly the tour guide ones. So to get started, I'm going to introduce all the speakers, and then we'll just start. First, we'll go with Margaret, and then we're going to get a snapshot of Charlottesville in the whole. Then we're going to get a sort of micro look at medicine and treatment over 100 years, and then we're going to go back to Charlottesville as a whole. So we're wrapping up the medical care around Charlottesville, or we're wrapping Charlottesville around the medical care, which is not so unusual. So going from my left, I'd like to welcome Aaron Brennan and Margaret Maslewski. They are co-authors of the book Charlottesville, and they are both local, and I think you'll enjoy their slides when we get to that. Then on my right, I have to always check, we have Henry Sharp, who has a PhD in architectural history and is working with the archives in the medical center. And next to him, we have Dr. M.C. Wilhelm, who is now retired, but has been a surgeon everybody knew in town for many years and relied on heavily. And then on my immediate left, we have Margaret O'Brien, who is the librarian at the Albemarle County Historical Society. She's a native of Franklin County, and she is stepping in to talk about the Guide to Historic Charlottesville and Albemarle County by Gene Cooper. Gene Cooper is at Semester at Sea, and so the commute was a little far. And so we're going to start off with Margaret and this tour around Charlottesville. And I've got all these little things in my book. And the reason is because there's a whole lot of interesting tours to take. And so Margaret can tell us something about how the book's organized. It's really very well organized for the tourists and the non-tourists, the people that live here. No. So Margaret, you're on. Okay,
thank you. Jean is the lucky one, of course. She's currently in South Africa. The Semester at Sea ship is in Cape Town, somewhere close to there. I thought I would start by telling you a little about Jean and her preparation and background for preparing this work. She is a librarian at the University of Virginia, has been there for well over 20 years. She's currently the Sponsored Programs and Information Services Librarian, basically an Alderman library. She has had particular interest in history, in the digitization of bibliographic sources, and in genealogical research. She herself has been active in several genealogical groups and research here in town, the Central Virginia Genealogical Association, as well as the African American Genealogy Group. She has done lots of personal research for a number of people. She's come to my library to do research work and that type of thing, and she's, of course, the immense resources that are at the university system has employed those also. She's been particularly interested, I think, in working with African-American genealogical research because of its different challenges and satisfactions of working with that. She has had several other publications previous to this guide, which include a genealogical index to guides of records of antebellum southern plantations, a revised edition of Virginia genealogy, which is something that Alderman Library has prepared through, I think, at least three editions, and also in her most recent work, which is an index to students of the University of Virginia, 1825 to 1874. That's a very useful thing. We not infrequently would get questions about someone who was a student at the university in 1843. It's very hard to find information very particular about people like that, and Jean has worked with records at the university to prepare that index, and I think it's going to be a useful thing. I think all of her interests have combined in the preparation and writing of this guidebook. It is a guidebook with both walking tours of Scottsville and Charlottesville and driving tours of both of those places, as well as loops going out into the county, which the reader can follow either in toto, starting at the beginning and going all the way through, or stopping at any place along the way, or just whatever may strike your interest. As anything that deals with the history of our area needs to do, she deals with first the settlement of Virginia, the condition and inhabitants of Virginia before European settlers came, the time when they did arrive here, how settlement spread from the Tidewater area up the river system, particularly the James River, and into the Piedmont of Virginia, and particularly in this case to Scott's Landing, which was the starting of Albemarle County as we now know it. She has sections in the book on the Revolutionary War period, the period from independence up to the Civil War, the Civil War itself, and the postbellum period up to 1925. She doesn't try to deal with new topics after 1925. If you're doing a tour of the area, you, of course, are going to come upon objects, buildings, and other things of interest that of course, lap over beyond that period, and she does discuss them fully in her treatment. For the rest of my presentation, I thought I would just mention, have selected particular topics that Gene touches on, ones that I think are interesting, and some of them may be unusual. I'm sure that there is no one out here who's never heard of any of these, and many of you have heard of quite a bit of this, but I hope it will be an interesting topic to examine at any rate. During the Revolutionary period, she discusses at some length Jack Jewett's ride. Speaking as someone who moved here in the mid-1970s, there were a number of things that I didn't know about the history of this area before I came here. One of them was Jack Jewett's ride. This took place in June of 1781. Jack Jewett himself, or John Jewett Jr., his given name, was a member of the Virginia militia, a young man. He was the son of John Jewett, who was a tavern keeper at the Swan Tavern on Court Square here in Charlottesville. Jack was in, I think as part of his militia duties or a result of it, was in eastern Louisa County at Cuckoo Tavern in early June of 1781 when he became aware of a fast-moving troop of British cavalry going through Cuckoo. They had paused there for a while, but obviously were going to move on quickly. He surmised that this group were probably headed for Charlottesville to try to capture the Virginia legislature and then Governor Jefferson, who had fled to Charlottesville from Richmond because of British activity and threats in the Richmond area. He decided that he thought he could ride to Charlottesville and Monticello to warn Jefferson and the legislature about the approach of the British, and did so. He figured that the British were going to take the more traveled route, which is roughly along present-day Virginia 22. He was correct in that, and he then decided to go a more southerly route that was shorter. It was still about 40 miles, but it was considerably rougher. So he and his horse rode through the night over that 40-mile trek. The British rode through the night, too. They made a few more stops, which is probably the salvation of the peace. But Jack Jewett got to Monticello first and to warn Governor Jefferson, and then into town to warn the members of the legislature in enough time that most of them got away, and Jefferson himself was able to leave after sending his family ahead to leave and head south towards other friends, neighbors, and properties. As I say, most of the legislature escaped. Some did not. And the thing that was interesting to me was when I first saw this was they said Daniel Boone was captured. And I thought, Daniel Boone, what's going on here? So at that time, Daniel Boone was the representative of Kentucky County to the Virginia House of Delegates. Kentucky was not yet a separate state and wasn't made so until after independence, well after, in 1792. So he was here from Kentucky but representing his area in the Virginia legislature. He was held captive for a couple of days, supposedly in a coal cellar in the east of town. But Jewett's ride is a very significant event in its enabling the legislature and Thomas Jefferson to escape capture. If the British had captured all these people, they would have had in their custody the author of the Declaration of Independence, as well as a number of other people who had signed the Declaration, and things would not have fared well with them and may have changed the course of some of the rest of the war period, too. Another local revolutionary-related event in the county, again, that I didn't know of before I came here, was the existence of the Albemarle Barracks, which is northwest of the city in the acreage behind where Albemarle High School is now. It was a prison camp for British and German prisoners who had been captured at the Battle of Saratoga in late 1777. Under a convention between the two parties, the Americans and the British, this group of prisoners were kept intact and moved around to several different locations. The Continental Congress and other state authorities, military authorities, came to the conclusion that they were in too much of an urban area. They had been in Boston and some other much more populated areas. It was hard to keep control of this group of prisoners, and they wanted to move them to somewhere more isolated. So they chose Albemarle County, which basically at that time was pretty much the middle of nowhere. It was far away from urban populations in a very agricultural area, so there would not be a lot surrounding them. The prisoners were brought here and arrived in January of 1779 in the middle of the winter. There was nothing that had been prepared for them, and the Hessians and German prisoners basically had to build their own shelter, which they did. And in Aaron and Margaret's book, they have chosen as an illustration a very nice engraving, which is the only real known illustration of the Albemarle Barracks. If you get a chance to take a look at one of the books, you might take a look at this. But this shows prisoners and officers around in the area. But it's the only really known illustration of the barracks. At the time they were there, this prison camp was by far the largest population center in Albemarle County. Charlottesville at this time, as was described by one of the British officers in his memoirs, Charlottesville was nothing but a courthouse, a tavern, and about eight houses, because that could be said for most Virginia County seats at that time. But the barracks was certainly a big population center. They were kept here for about 2 years until the decision was made to move them on, first to Winchester and then to other areas. And the event lives on, of course, in names around here, Barracks Road and Hessian and all the things that have been given that name that ultimately came from these barracks during the Revolutionary War. Kind of jumping around a bit, I wanted to mention next William Holmes McGuffey and his time in Charlottesville. He was a Presbyterian minister who came to the University of Virginia in the 1840s. He already had written a number of his very well-known McGuffey's readers and was one of the best-known people in the country at that time. He came to the university as a professor of moral philosophy, taught there, and was also a minister of the Charlottesville Presbyterian Church. He also continued to work on readers, and the legend is that he prepared new texts for his readers, that he tried them out on groups of children in the garden behind the pavilion where he lived, which was Pavilion 9. The tree where this supposedly happened was for many years called the McGuffey Ash, and because of its own age and ill health, finally had to be taken down several years ago. Also near the university is a neighborhood with the name of the Canada neighborhood, and kind of intriguing one. This was the location of a pre-Civil War residential area for largely freed blacks and other slaves. These people performed service work for the university, laundry and seamstress and other labor types of activities. I think that probably the name was given to it by the residents themselves, and I think is a kind of allegorical reference to a place that would represent real safety for a fugitive slave or a previously enslaved person. It would be good to get to a free northern state, but ultimately, even in those states, people were at least legally obliged to turn fugitive slaves in, and Canada, being a foreign country and the closest nearby, would represent real freedom for these people. One family in particular, the Catherine and Kitty Foster family, is known to have lived there for 90 years. A lot of this was discovered when archaeological and excavation work was done by the university in the mid-90s for new construction. They discovered archaeological remains of dwellings and also a good number of graves in that area. And those have, although construction has certainly gone on around the area, they have created a commemorative and explanatory area about the history of it there. Another neighborhood that had been created by newly freed blacks after the Civil War is the Prophet neighborhood to the northeast of the city. it was largely populated by newly freed black people until 1881, when the Southern Railroad constructed their new main line north of Charlottesville. It came through that area. More residents moved in, and it became a really thriving railroad community for a number of years. It's only sort of slowing down in the early to mid-20th century. Also of interest is near Prophet. There was a sulfur mine in the early 20th century, which was the only sulfur mine in Virginia. It was active particularly during the years of World War I, when there was a more demand for it, but it never, according to Jared Lowenstein, who is the Prophet expert, of course, I think its yield was never terribly great, but during wartime there was a real demand for it, so it kept up through the end of that. As the final thing that I want to mention during my segment, this is one that I just think is Jean has covered very well in her book, and one that sort of resonates for me. I think it's well stated, and its implications are quite good. And that is the tour to America of the Marquis de Lafayette in 1824-25. Lafayette, of course, was a hero of the Revolution, a French person, an officer, who had participated with his forces to aid in the cause of American independence. And the French help, of course, was essential in finally securing that. He had been very close to George Washington, had served under him, and had become a friend of Thomas Jefferson during the war. In 1824, when Lafayette was 66, he had been invited by the U.S. Congress to visit the United States. He accepted and came with one of his sons with the intention of only staying 3 months. He was so rapturously received everywhere he went that they wound up staying 14 months. sort of nice to be received that way. This period of the 1820s was one of great expansion from eastern states further west as more land opened up. I think that's part of the reason, both this visit and the expansion at the same time, that there are so many places in the United States named Fayette, Lafayette, Fayetteville, all of which were named after the Marquis de Lafayette in honor of his visit. Jean quotes from the book, The Domestic Life of Thomas Jefferson, about this visit, and I would like to read it to you. I think it resonates. Lafayette and his party had come from Washington, Richmond, and then were coming on to Charlottesville, were always received with ceremony wherever they went, but he did want to get here in order to visit with Thomas Jefferson. The lawn on the eastern side of the house at Monticello contains not quite an acre. On this spot was the meeting of Jefferson and Lafayette on the latter's visit to the United States. The barouche containing Lafayette stopped at the edge of this lawn. His escort, 120 mounted men, formed on one side in a semicircle extending from the carriage to the house. A crowd of about 200 men, who were drawn together by curiosity to witness the meeting of these two venerable men, formed themselves in a semicircle on the opposite side. As Lafayette descended from the carriage, Jefferson descended the steps of the portico. The scene which followed was touching. Jefferson was feeble and tottering with age, Lafayette permanently lamed and broken in health by his long confinement in the dungeon of Olmutz. As they approached each other, their uncertain gait quickened itself into a shuffling run, and exclaiming, "Ah, Jefferson, ah, Lafayette," they burst into tears as they fell into each other's arms. Among the 400 men witnessing the scene, there was not a dry eye, no sound save an occasional suppressed sob. The two old men entered the house as the crowd dispersed in profound silence. That account, as I said, is from The Domestic Life of Thomas Jefferson. It was written by one of Jefferson's great-granddaughters, Sarah Nicholas Randolph. She was the daughter of Jefferson's favorite grandson, Thomas Jefferson Randolph. She herself was born in 1839, so she wasn't there. So I think she's recalling this from what her father related to her. I have no doubt he was there, relating to her about the event. And in connection with that, I want to close off by using Aaron and Margaret's book here and their cover. This is one of the beautiful Holsinger photographs. This one was taken in September of 1917 of a parade on Main Street here in Charlottesville, which was honoring the Monticello Guard. This was, I think you all say, that the next day the Guard was leaving for training at Fort McClellan, Alabama, training in order to embark to go to France with the American Expeditionary Force in World War I. So they were part of the group, the force that the commander, General John Pershing, represented as they arrived in France. And General Pershing's first words when he stepped onto French soil were, "Lafayette, we are here." And I think that resonates greatly, both in its simplicity and profundity, and the fact that our people here from Monticello Guard were involved in the circle of the effort of France and America in the Revolution to secure independence for us. The remembrance of that when Lafayette and Jefferson reunited with each other very tellingly, and then following on another loop and circle in American efforts to assist France in maintaining their independence and liberty. So that's all.
That really wasn't all, but
there's a lot more.
That's all you're going to do right now.
Right.
That was fascinating. I was hoping you'd touch on Jack Jewett's ride because I thought, as I was reading that, I made notes and I'm going to go do on the ride. I wish I could ride a horse and enjoy it that way. Next, we're going to learn about the history of cancer care at the University of Virginia, and MC and Henry have decided how they're going to divide that up, so you're on.
It's a pleasure to be with you here and sort of share with you some of the evolution of the development of cancer care at the university. And the book, you'll see that it says from 1901 to 2011. 1901 was chosen because that was when the first University of Virginia hospital was built. Now, this came about, this book, by reminiscing one day down in Special Collections of the library about one of our lost colleagues, and we recognized that though he was extremely well known from a scientific standpoint, very little was really known about the role that he played in the development of the Cancer Center. So we thought that it was a shame, and we went about trying to recreate some of the role that he did play. And then we realized that there were still individuals in the community that we really needed to tap to get their history of the evolution of cancer. So we did 25 videotaped interviews of doctors, nurses, and technicians who had played a role over time in the development of the cancer program at the university. We also then went back and started looking at all the material we could find. Now, the university hospital back in the 40s put out a little sheet called the draw sheet. And this was put out every week in the hospital. It was just a little simple two-page sheet. But it gave information about what was going on in the hospital. And that was a tremendous amount of information. And then we started looking at the Medical Alumni News and the Helix magazine. And we realized by this time, I think, that we were sort of hooked. And Joan Klein, who is the director of Special Collections at the library, said the library would back us trying to go further with this. Well, in this material, we came across an interesting fact, which will certainly be of interest to most of you in Charlottesville, that a philanthropist named Paul Goodloe McIntyre came on the scene, and his wife had died of cancer. And he came to the university hospital in 1933 and gave them $100,000 to develop a cancer center. Well, $100,000 in 1933, as you can imagine, was a humongous amount of money. The administration realized that they knew nothing about a cancer center. So they sent Dr. Vincent Archer, who was a radiologist, and Dr. Goodwin, who was a surgeon, to Memorial Hospital in New York, which was the only real center in this country where cancer was emphasized, to sort of learn what a cancer center was and how it worked and how you go about it. Well, they went up and spent a few months up there and came back just full of enthusiasm about how we're going to develop a cancer center at the University of Virginia. And their enthusiasm, however, they found didn't quite suit everybody else. Though the administration itself seemed pretty interested in this, it turned out that the chairman of the departments weren't really interested in the center. This turns out to be a pattern that's been in the United States and certainly the university for a number of years. Chairmen don't like centers because they lose control of their faculty and of their residents, and they also lose control of their money. So as a result, we didn't have a cancer center, but we had the McIntyre Tumor Clinic, which was patterned after the clinics in Memorial, and were certainly one of the early types of cancer clinics in that day. Now, as we gathered all this information, we realized, what are we going to do with it, and how are we going to put it together? So along came Hal. Hal had worked in the special collections of the library while he was working on his PhD, and so he knew medical terminology and knew the people, and he seemed like the logical person to help us put all this information we had gathered together. So now I'll let Hal take over a little bit about his role. Well,
thank you, MC. MC and I have a very good working relationship, both very strong-minded, and MC says it's a good thing he's a surgeon and not a writer, and it's a good thing I'm a writer and not a surgeon. And on top of that, when I was working at the Health Sciences Library Historical Collections, Joan Klein, the director there, kindly put us together so we could get the project going. And at the same time, I had just begun working on my dissertation and was wildly optimistic about how much time it would take to do that. And perhaps foolishly agreed to take on yet another writing project at the same time. So I advise any of you who are pursuing that path, double the amount of time you think you're going to take to write the dissertation, and be very careful about what else you actually engage to write at the same time. But we got along well. It was a fun project and actually really fascinating to learn about the long history of cancer care and medical care at the University of Virginia. And because we don't have much time, I'll just read you very quickly a note that Jefferson, because we can't actually have any session intros without mentioning him, Jefferson wrote to John Adams and Abigail Adams at the end of their political careers, which had been quite divisive for a number of years. There was a reconciliation brought about by Abigail Adams. And there is a wonderful collection published in the 1950s of letters between the two men at the end of their lives. And during this time, John and Abigail Adams' daughter contracted and ultimately died of breast cancer. She had surgery, a mastectomy essentially, and lived for about two more years. And Abigail's letter is quite lovely relative to this great loss of hers, and Jefferson responds in this way: "I know the depth of the affliction it has caused and can sympathize with it the more sensibly, inasmuch as there is no degree of affliction produced by the loss of those dear to us which experience has not taught me to estimate." He had lost, of course, his own wife as a young woman. "I have ever found time and silence the only medicine, and these but assuage and can never suppress the deep drawn sigh which recollection forever brings up until recollection and life are extinguished together." Now, I'll finish by saying Jefferson wasn't actually entirely silent. Certainly in dealing with grief and loss, which many of us confront in friends and family members, but Jefferson's dedication to scientific medicine lay the foundations for the medical school here at the University of Virginia and charted a path for the university, which was taken up by other physicians and professors, men and women, who built the medical program and ultimately the cancer treatment program. And beginning with the official proposal with the McIntyre donation in the 30s, ultimately were able to bring about this unification of all of the different medical specialties in a new building, which we find now at the Couric Cancer Center, both at the very forefront of medical care and a very old idea. Turn it back to you, MC.
Just a couple things was interesting and historically was during World War I, the university formed an evacuation hospital just as they did in World War II, and they were stationed in most of the time in France and near Paris. And Dr. Goodwin, who was the chief surgeon of the hospital and the head nurse of the hospital, spent a lot of time in Paris. And at that time, the Curie Institute had just really developed radium. So they had the opportunity to visit the Curie Institute rather frequently and came back to this country. And Dr. Goodwin convinced Dr. Stephen Watts, who was a professor of surgery, to buy a source of radium, and this was the first source certainly in this part of the country. They didn't know much about radium, but at least the word is that Dr. Watts bought it with his own money, which is not unusual at the university. We did have the first radium really in this center. Now, as I mentioned, we did these video interviews, and this was fascinating, probably one of the most enjoyable parts of this whole project, but listening to the various individuals and the history of their involvement with their careers, which were involved with cancer over time, was really fascinating. And I'll end this with just one statement. Dr. Mike Williams, who is an internationally known lymphoma expert, in his interview he was talking about lymphoma. And he said, you know, MC, when I got started in this, there were two kinds of lymphoma, Hodgkin's disease and non-Hodgkin's disease. He said, now there are 80 different variants of lymphoma. And this just gives you an idea of the progress that has been made in looking at cancer and how we approach its treatment. The interviews are all on CD discs or DVD discs in the book. And if you may know some of the people, it's fascinating to really listen to the evolution of their careers and the role it's played in the cancer program at the university. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. And now we're in for a tour. And Aaron is going to lead us around primarily downtown, I think, but maybe not. I'm not sure where she's taking us, actually, but it will be in the vicinity of Charlottesville.
Thank you. As Nancy mentioned, my name is Erin. This is Margaret Malaszewski, and thanks so much for coming today. I'll just say a few words about the process of writing the book. When Arcadia called and asked if we wanted to do this, I actually wondered why it hadn't been done before. I've always kind of enjoyed these books, and I've purchased them from the various places that I've lived, so I was familiar with the books. And they had, in fact, approached other people in Charlottesville in the past to do the book, but no one took up the offer, and I think we quickly realized and found out why. Probably the thing that we were least aware of getting into the process and the most difficult aspect of it was getting permission to publish some of the images. That was always a factor when we were considering whether or not to put an image in a book, was whether we could get the permission. For instance, special collections of all the various collections that they have, they only actually own the rights to just a few of them. So we ended up contacting people all over the country, former students, alumni, to get permission to publish some of the images that we were able to put in the book. Also, I think in general, it's just a challenge to construct the history of a place using really only photographs. You have to weave together a coherent narrative with a finite number of images that hopefully encapsulate the myriad different experiences that people have in one place. As a historian, I'm accustomed to writing that history, but with photographs, you kind of have to step back and let others tell the story through the kind of visual vignettes that you select to put in the book. And on the one hand, because you are narrating photographs that were taken at that time, there's a kind of contemporaneousness because the images really put you right there. But on the other hand, you have to step back and understand that readers are, through memory, are going to connect to these images in ways that you can't always anticipate. So we felt that it was really important to take, you know, a very kind of minimalist position and keep the captions just very simple and as short as possible, but as well framing the context of each image, giving you enough information to understand what you were looking at, but then kind of step back from that and allow readers to fill in their own history through memory as they were looking through the images themselves. So today we're just going to show a few slides that didn't make the cut. As we mentioned in the acknowledgement, we searched through over 15,000 images from 30 different public and private collections. From there, we whittled it down to 600 images. And so we had some really difficult choices at the end to select the 223 that we were able to put in the book. So the images I'll show today are not in the book. These are ones just kind of rarely seen views of people, places, or events. And I selected more of the fun images that we came across in our research. So I'll just end with that, and we'll go for it. So this is the First Baptist Church that was constructed in 1904 on the corner of Lee Park, where the Queen Charlotte condo now stands. And this was a beautiful Romanesque revival structure that burned down in 1977. We have a great image of that fire by Jim Carpenter in the book, but I wanted to show these here today because this is the only interior view of the church that we came across in all of our research. And I hear from all the people we interviewed and discussed and talked with about during the process of writing this book that it was a stunning interior. So that was just one of our favorites. Of course, we have images in the book of the rotunda before and after the 1895 fire, but these are kind of two rarely seen views that we came across in special collections, the before and after of the annex particularly, so a nice side view. So I wanted to show those today. And these are... this is, of course, the anatomical theater, which Jefferson constructed in 1825, designed. The image on the left provides a really good perspective of the location of this building in relationship to the rotunda on the right and then the chapel on the left, so you get a really good idea of where this building was located. And then on the right, again, one of the few interior shots that we came across, in fact, the only one. This is just a very kind of rare view of Market Street. And this is from the Holzinger Collection, of course, at Special Collections. This is about circa 1900. This is one of my favorites. This is three UVA students dressed up for a game at Lambeth Field. Of course, the Lambeth Colonnade, which was built in 1913, is visible in the background. There was no narration or there was no description of this image. It's just one of my favorites. I don't know why, but it's just great. So that one we didn't include, but again, a favorite. Another Holzinger image of just kids getting ready for some sort of pageant at McGuffey, in front of McGuffey School. Very, very touching. There were a lot of these, obviously, in the Holzinger collection. Train wrecks that occurred, disasters, plane crashes and such. This was one of the better images that we liked of a train crash that happened just outside of Charlottesville. And this is, there's several of the Southern Depot, but this was an interesting perspective of it. You can see the pedestrian bridge that that train riders took to get to Main Street, and then the Queen Charlotte Hotel is kind of visible there on the left of the bridge. So that was just an interesting perspective. I was actually just when I trained in yesterday here stuck in traffic now. It's quite busy these days. This is a great old shot of Wortland. Of course, very different today, obviously, but what was once pasture land is now UVA Studentville, so just a great perspective there. We did include one of these images in the book, and there are several. They are a series of portraits of student actors who dressed up for their parts for the Oh, Susie Behave musical production in 1919. Just great, great images. The musical was produced and directed entirely by UVA students, and it was consisted of a series of vignettes of very popular contemporary musical productions that were occurring in New York City at that time. It was wildly successful. So they actually ended up taking the production on the road and traveling all over the state of Virginia. They were invited to do this in New York City, but they had to go to school. They couldn't leave school. So they weren't able to go up there and do this on Broadway, but they did travel all over Virginia and do this. The next series of images was taken by Ed Roseberry, who's joined us today. Thank you very much for coming. He's a local photographer known as Flash, who contributed greatly to this book. And this is Ed on the right, and this is his brother in the foreground on the left, and they're enjoying a beer at Carol's Tea Room, which was, of course, located at the intersection of Barracks and 29 North. Some of you may remember that. This is a student who's had a little too much fun at Carol's, and he's just kind of sleeping it off in his car. And then this image was taken in 1955. One of my faves. This is a great image of two, this is both one of Margaret and I's favorites, two ladies attending a wedding in Keswick. And Ed says that the lady on the left claimed that she was the first female recipient of a PhD at UVA. It's just a great classic image.
What was her name? I'm sorry.
Ed, do you know her name?
Yes. It was the last name Mead.
M-E-A-D.
M-E-A-D.
Janet Mead. Janet Mead. Didn't include this in the book, obviously not a lot of historical context there, but just a great image that we came across. Ed had several of these kind of images that were taken with a fisheye lens, which was really popular, of course, in the 70s, and it was tempting to use several of these images in the book, but we didn't want to choose an image just for the sake of it being a great image. It had to tell more of a story, obviously, and contribute to this kind of historical narrative of Charlottesville. We did include one of these images in the book, and it was of the interior of the Rotunda as it was being demolished during the 1970s reconstruction of Jefferson's quote-unquote original interior, which is a controversial subject, I understand. But this is a really... the one we included of the rotunda is a really interesting image because you can see the entire space in the round. So you can see the oculus as well as all the demolition that's occurring. That's what's great about these kinds of images. But just a good image of Easter celebration in 1975 that we really liked. And this is, and Ed had several images of Charlottesville's bicentennial celebration in 1962. And the men were required to grow beards, and the image on the right shows Ed with his beard taking a picture of the time capsule that was being placed in the ground at that time. And then the image on the left was taken during one of the July festivities, kind of the mock jail, where if men didn't grow a beard, they were kind of captured and thrown into. So this being what we're, the 250th celebration happening this year, this is these were just a great series of images. We do have a couple of images also in the book from that celebration. Another one of the kind of in the round images, this is, of course, of the dome room at Monticello. We thought long and hard about this one. We had to include an image of the dome room, but do we do this one or do we do a more traditional one? We opted for the more traditional one. We loved this one, again, because you can see the entire room in the image. But we did go for the more traditional view of this, but just another fantastic image. This is probably a rare view taken of the train tracks near the coal tower in 1951. Didn't get down there much. I mean, of course, we did a lot of walking for the book and looking at these places and what they look like today. So this is just kind of a rarely seen view, I think.
There was a turntable there as well. I don't know whether that shows. That fascinated me. I love that.
Ed took several images of weekend shenanigans all over the corner and Rugby Avenue in the 1960s, and these are just a couple of those images taken in 1963 on the left and 68 on the right. Many of these images actually were included in an exhibition at the Bailey Art Museum in the 1980s titled The Inward Eye, and there's a little book on it in Special Collections that has selected images from that exhibition with some text, and it's really a fascinating exhibition and completely local. I'm dearly hoping that Ed will be putting out a book on his collection of images of Charlottesville, because he covers quite a span of history here, an important history. We did include two images from Rock Hudson and Elizabeth Taylor's 10-day stint in the Charlottesville area during the filming of Giant in 1956, and these were other images that Ed took of that event. The image on the top left is not only just a beautifully composed image, but you can clearly see the name Ardmore on the old Keswick Railroad Station, which I believe has since been demolished. Rumor has it that they changed the name to Ardmore because Elizabeth didn't really want to affect a kind of southern accent for the part. And then the image on the right shows Rock getting off the train and speaking to Paul Fix, who's the owner of Belmont Farm, where parts of the movie were filmed. And then the image on the bottom left shows the team conversing before a scene is shot. So these are just, again, beautiful images. Yeah, that's Easter's. So we do include a couple of really great images that people contributed to the book of the infamous Easter celebration. And this one really puts you right in the middle of it. And you can see why it was referred to as the best party in the country. And also why it was increasingly dangerous and eventually canceled at the university in 1982. Our own little mini Woodstock. And you can see the students kind of rallying on the roofs of the dorms, and then the buses in the background on the left that are hauling in students from all over the country. All over the country they came for this celebration. So it got, I'm sure it was interesting. This is the only image that I'm showing here today that is actually we did include in the book, but this is absolutely one of my favorites, and this is it's a Rip Payne photograph, and that collection is held at the Albemarle Charlottesville Historical Society, a wonderful, rich collection of images that they're still culling through, I know. And this one was actually only in negative form. So with Steve's permission, we had it printed, and we were really excited when we saw it because it's one of the few exterior shots that we found of the Lafayette Theater before it was demolished in 1960. You can see it there on the left. And this is also a great image of the Purley Building, which is the image on the left in the foreground, which was a furniture store founded by James Purley in the 1880s. And this is where the terraces are now located on the downtown mall. So you can really get a sense of how much has changed. This is a great image also, a Rip Payne photograph of the fire at the old Elks Lodge located on High Street. When we met with Preston Quinery, had some great stories about how that deer head was salvaged by somebody. But anyway, this building was kind of defunct for a while, but it's recently been restored. And brought back to life. So, but this is what the original facade looked like. This is just a great series of images taken by Rip Payne of a frozen turkey truck crash in front of the Rockfish Gap Country Store. I don't think anyone was injured, but there were a lot of frozen turkeys everywhere, and you can see the people kind of sorting through the debris on the top left. This guy has obviously found a few intact turkeys that he wants to take home with him. And on the bottom, the ladies discussing, you know, kind of how the accident happened. I think that's the crashed truck there in the top right. So just, again, a great vignette, little story series of images there that we really enjoyed. These images were taken by local photographer Jim Carpenter, who now owns Gitchell Studio, and we did include one image of the Queen Elizabeth's visit to Charlottesville in 1976 to celebrate the nation's bicentennial that is in the book, but these are a few of the other really great images that we saw. Of course, the one especially of the Queen looking over her shoulder at the camera is just a classic image. And then the ladies on the bottom left, I believe Jim mentioned that they were members of the Garden Club of Virginia, and they're just absolutely excited to meet Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh there, just very delighted. So just, again, a great series of images. You know, of course, everyone here is familiar with the story of the downtown mall and the transformation that happened there, but these images kind of convey a bit that evolution of East Main Street. Jim Carpenter took the image on the top left in the early 70s, and then Jack Looney, a local photographer who also contributed to the book, some wonderful contemporary images of the downtown mall, aerials as well as on the ground, took that one recently on the bottom right. And so, of course, you see the transformation of the street once illuminated by neon signs and street lights, and how brightly lit it was night, brightly lit it was at night, all the Leggett stores, all the old department stores, and then now, you know, lit with tree lights and pedestrian walking lights and such. So again, that kind of just that transformation there being quite extraordinary over time. This is a great image also by Jim Carpenter of Gerald Ford standing in front of Thomas Jefferson's grave at Monticello. This was taken in 1976 when he was visiting. Just a very good, well-composed image, I thought. These are a couple of images taken by John Shepard between 1970 and 1973. The one on the left was taken in front of Ing's Grocery Store, which is now, of course, West Main Street Restaurant. And then the one on the right was taken at the end of the downtown mall shortly after the demolition of Vinegar Hill. We have some a fabulous series in the book, and we really wanted to show that transformation of, you know, before and after the demolition of Vinegar Hill and the construction of the how the streets changed. So we have a lot of before and afters from the same vantage point to try to really convey how that changed in a very short period of time. But you can see on the right the Jefferson School in the background before, you know, the federal building, any of that was constructed at that much later in the 80s. This is one of my absolute favorites. This is a wonderful image by Bill Emery of the Albemarle Morris men dancing in Woolen Mills on May Day. It's funny, I lived in Woolen Mills, and I woke up, it was May Day, which is also my birthday, woke up, had some coffee, and I see these men dressed like this walking down the street, and I kind of like turned and just was like, am I missing? Am I still dreaming? So I looked into this. And so Morris is a type of traditional English folk dancing once practiced in the Cotswolds in England. The tradition had really all but died during the Industrial Revolution, but then was later revived by English antiquarians who visited the remaining dancers and recorded the steps and then the music. And so the Albemarle Morris men have been performing in and around Charlottesville since 1978. So every year they kind of come down, dressed up, and dance near the river. And it's just, again, a very beautifully composed image of early spring in Charlottesville. So. The final image I'll leave you with today, this is a kind of funny image of men dressed up as Lafayette, Jefferson, Monroe, Madison, and Washington inspecting the site for the University of Virginia through Jefferson's telescope. So there was lots of wonderful, hilarious images of men dressed up as Jefferson throughout the ages from the 70s, you know, all the way back to Holzinger's time in the 20s and 30s. So it was in the teens. So there were lots of these images that we came across that were just really fun. So we'd be happy to answer any questions. That's all we have today. And if you want to see more, it's certainly in the book. Thank you.
Thank you. That was a wonderful show. And I liked how you included the difficulty of trying to decide which to put in, which not to put in, and then you're still left with a whole lot of decisions.
Absolutely.
So anybody who's tried to put an album of any sort together of their own comes across that, but I think in this one it was a rather monumental issue. So appreciate that. I saw some things I didn't know, and that was fun. I did have one question that I thought maybe MC or Hal could address. There were two questions, actually. First of all, when you go through this book in the early time, the difference of money and how people were treated is something that has historically gone forward. And I found that to be very interesting, and you might maybe you could comment on that. And then the other thing I thought was interesting was the effect of war on the progression of cancer care. It was out of the war that new approaches came. And I wonder if you could just address somewhat quickly those two issues.
Well, I think the chemotherapy is interesting because mustard gas had been developed, and they happened to have some mustard gas on a Navy ship, and some sailors got inadvertently exposed. and it was found that their white blood counts dropped practically to nothing. So some very adept physicians decided, gee, if this can knock white blood count down, maybe we can use it for treatment. So we get chemotherapy, because leukemia, of course, the white blood count goes off the roof. So here all of a sudden you had a drug developed which accidentally turned out to be one of our good chemotherapy agents. Another thing I'd like to say, just a minute, the house on Wortland Street, which you showed in the very beginning, still exists.
Yeah.
And is among the historical registry.
Mm-hmm.
And I happened to have lived in that house when I was in medical school. not back in the very beginning, but but it was a medical fraternity house, and we had a few medical fraternity houses because that's where we lived when we went to medical school in those days.
Oh, dear.
Well,
I guess the other issue.
To take up your first question, basically across the street, if you continue down 13th across West Main from Wortland, MC's old fraternity house, there was a building called the Dispensary, which was the first purpose-built structure for medical care at UVA, setting aside the anatomical theater, which was actually an educational building, although there was also in the 19th century a clinic operated there. And one of the issues relative to the establishment of the University Hospital in 1901 is, in a way it's kind of odd to say it, but it was fear. People were afraid of pulling together individuals who were sick and close to the university, where there were students trying to learn. And also there was a class issue, so that the university leadership was not convinced that a hospital could actually work, because respectable people, that is people, code words for people who were more well-to-do, were generally treated at home. And if you were to come into a hospital, it was in a way kind of an admission that you didn't have the income to do that. And so the old Berenger, Professor Berenger, who was very much instrumental in setting up the hospital, one of these men like Jefferson, very much interested in scientific medicine and the professionalization of medical practice, was able to overcome that natural resistance. But even within the hospital itself, it was the building from 1901 forward until the civil rights movement came in. There were divisions by race and by gender, and so African American wings, men and women, were down in the basement of the original hospital, and men's and women's wards were upstairs. People who ultimately, once the hospital grew further, people who had greater resources, and the stigma of a public hospital had by the 20s and 30s and 40s begun to recede. Many of those individuals who had money actually could afford their own room or a smaller room. So you had people who didn't want to be treated in the ward but could afford private rooms. And in fact, one of the wings, the Berenger wing, built was for private, mm-hmm. to try and help capitalize on this desire of people who had a little bit more income, and then to come in and use those rooms, and that money would then help and in turn support the operation of the hospital. So the whole issue of
cost was there from the very beginning.
Absolutely.
Which I hadn't really thought of, and so when I read that in the book, I thought, oh my goodness, well, we're still doing a lot of the things, aren't we, that we were doing way back.
Yes, and what struck me in doing the research relative to the period of the Depression was how overwhelming the need was. That the letters from the hospital administrators and the physicians who were in charge of it over and over mention how people are coming and needing medical care and aren't able to pay, and the demand for the use of the facilities was so great that they could just barely keep up with the space and with the
Very quickly.
Okay. One historical fact is that when Thomas Jefferson was the governor of Virginia, he spent quite a time in Williamsburg. And in 1778, while he was there, Jefferson didn't like hospitals because he thought they were terrible and they spread disease. So they organized in Williamsburg the first home health care system in the United States, and the patients were moved out of the hospital into the private home.
Oh,
and they were taken care of by the individuals in that house, and they were actually paid by the local community. And this is probably one of the first times we have federally subsidized or government subsidized home health care.
Okay, I'll open it up for questions from the audience if you have some. If you would raise your hand high, and we have a roving microphone, and our roving microphone will come to you. And if you would just give your name and then ask your question down here in the blue.
Hi, Doctor. My name is Jim Hill. I've been here for 10, 12 years. You have been here much longer and have seen a lot. We have recently seen the Couric building being built. We've seen the Battle building under construction. We've seen parking garages torn down and rebuilt. We've seen the new facade, the new front, et cetera, et cetera. What do you see as the future of this hospital complex?
Well, from a physical standpoint, it can't grow much further, as you know. I think the benefit of, I think, the cancer center, the Couric Center, and the children's hospital is that you are able to bring together all of the individuals involved in, say, cancer care and in pediatric care, rather than and the patient then doesn't have to traipse all over this whole facility and get lost. And this way, the patient will be stabilized and the physicians will come to the center. So I think that's what's going to make care progressively better. And I think that cancer care and certainly pediatric care is becoming very specialized and very individualized. And that's why it's very important, I think, for the individuals involved to be able to be together where they can talk to each other on a regular basis. And I think this is, and have tumor boards and all of this in these facilities. So I think that's where, you know, you can call it personalized care or whatever, but I think this is where care is developing, certainly in areas like pediatrics and in cancer.
Do you believe there's a limit in how large the hospital can be and still function efficiently?
Well, I think what's probably going to happen is you're going to have centers develop, whereas they never wanted centers. I think you're now obviously going to have them. Just like out at Fontaine, you have neurosurgery and orthopedics, whole complex. So I think what you're going to have is specialty complexes where the individuals involved in that particular specialty can be together. And I think that's how it's going to grow.
Are there any other questions?
My name is Jane Cox, and I have a particular interest in the 1760s, 1770 time period for the lady, young woman in the white jacket. When Peter Jefferson had his Shadwell plantation, you said earlier that there was a courthouse, a tavern. Would they have had like a marketplace, like we have Market Day here, for him to sell his surplus?
Yes. In colonial Virginia, and all, in fact on up into certainly the 19th and into the mid-20th century, it was a very common phenomenon to have court days, which were the days technically when the court was actually in session. And that would be the time when people would come to town to the county seat to transact their legal business, any actual legal cases that were being heard, to record deeds, record marriages, any kind of legal transactions. This, of course, was drawing people in, and there was a market there for various products, both places to stay, food, other, you know, amusements and products. So merchants and in many cases, you know, what amount to traveling salesmen would come through, you know, would come through at court day time in order to be there to offer things to people. That phenomenon went on for a very long time. You know, into the 20th century when transportation became much more common and commonly available. In my home county, in my childhood, court days was still a recognizable thing, a time when people came to town to do business, to various transactions and to buy and sell things. That was always held on a Monday or Tuesday, I think, of the week. since transportation has become almost universal, you know, with the private automobile, and which is widely held by almost everyone, now the time when, in a rural area, times when people come to town, if even if they're agriculturally oriented, is Saturday, you know, to do things.
Thomas Jefferson practice in that courthouse?
That's not
when yes.
Okay.
Yes, yes. The oldest part of the courthouse that exists now is the back portion, not the part with the portico, but the part behind it, which was built in 1803. And, yes, Jefferson did practice there some.
Okay, we have another question coming up. The mic's on its way.
Hello, my name is Sandra Barber. I'm formerly from Charlottesville. Now I'm a resident of Albemarle County. I'd just like to know, do you think that since we are celebrating this beautiful celebration, do you think Charlottesville and Albemarle County are still a wonderful place to live? Do you think it's still safe for future children and future grandparents to live here?
Anybody want to tackle that one? I think it got to me. I still think Charlottesville and Albemarle are a good place to raise a family. And I think the problems that we have here are disturbing. But I do think that the ray of hope is that people are, like you and me, are working on them. And I think it's going to take the that we can't look to somebody else to solve these problems, but that it's something that we all need to sit down and see what we can contribute to making this an even better place, because I recognize the fact that it is not the greatest place on earth for everyone. And I think there's a goal to try to make that happen, but you and I need to work on that. I don't think we can ask somebody else to do that. So I would say, It's a place of great promise still, and it can build on the history it has, and I hope change the direction of some of the history we have, because I think that's as important. I'm sorry, that's my answer. So thank you for that question, though.
My name is Carol Hill. One thing that no one has mentioned, Charlottesville was a textile center. And we've got postcards from the Historical Society out on the table. The building on Harris Street was a silk mill, and the woolen mills actually produced uniforms for the Civil War, World War I, and World War II. We were a textile center, and no one seems to remember that.
We include images of woolen. We address that. Yeah, the old, beautiful old images of the woolen mills proprietors and owners, and yeah.
And Jean has included that the woolen mills area on some of her tours within the city also.
So it just didn't all get out there today. So I hope that encourages you to look for some more. Now I need to bring the session to close. The authors will be down here to sell their books and sign them and to talk with you as well. I'd like to thank you all for being a wonderful audience and a participatory audience, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Thank you.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Beard.